Our next speaker is Dr. Ralph Chu. Ralph is the Associate Professor of Optometry at the School of Optometry at the University of Waterloo in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. He's been intimately involved with the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada for 30 years. He's led 8 or 9 eclipse expeditions and observed another half a dozen eclipses. And he's, again, we've got another world authority on the subject here. Nobody knows more about eye protection during eclipses than Ralph. He's done a lot of studies on filter transmission of various solar filters in the past and written in the Sky and Telescope about these. He's analyzed and measured some new filters that he's going to talk about today, and even talk a little bit about some of the litigious side of these things, with lawsuits with eye injuries. So I expect this to be quite an eye-opening topic for us all. Sorry. Don't hit your moderator. So Ralph will be speaking about eye safety, transmittance data, reports of eye injuries, lawsuits, and more.
Ralph Chu. Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to extend my thanks and appreciation to Patrick and Joanne for asking me to come back to speak to this meeting. I had a great time in Belgium in 2008, even though my jet lag caused me to almost oversleep my slot that morning. But that's another story. In any case, in the last 4 years, I've been looking at some more solar filters, and also, I've started dabbling with H-alpha filters, so that meant some development work for both Coronado and Thousand Oaks, and I'll show you some data from those bits and pieces of work. And then finally, I'm going to close by talking a little bit about some developments in Canadian school curricula with astronomy and the implications of a lawsuit that I was a consultant on, which arose out of the 1998 eclipse. So we'll begin, first of all, by just very quickly taking a look at a background on solar retinal burns for those of you who haven't heard too much about this topic before. The problem with burns to the eye that arise from looking at the sun without proper protection is that, number one, the injury occurs without any sensation of pain. The retina itself has no pain sensation at all, unlike the skin or the front of the eye. And as a result, the tissue can be very badly damaged without you knowing about it. And that's, in fact, why we can use, for example, lasers to do retinal burns for diabetes and a number of other procedures without anesthetic. So the thing is, first of all, there's no pain sensation. The second thing is that this is a true case of dead man walking, because the retina tissues that are damaged will continue to function for somewhere between 6 and 48 hours after they have been lethally damaged before they finally pack it in. And so this latent period is a characteristic of eclipse burns. And normally, when somebody presents with the problem, it's the day after the event. They sit down at breakfast and realize they can't read the paper, they can't see the face across the table from them. Then they go to the eye doctor, and everything goes on from there. Now, the situation is complicated by the fact that the chances of recovery of vision under these circumstances is very hard to predict. About 50% of cases will recover almost the same level of vision they had before the injury. The other 50% are out of luck. But on initial presentation, when we take a look at those eyes, we can't tell what is going to happen. And so that is another complicating factor. And finally, we also have to consider whether or not the individual is using an optical aid like a telescope or camera lens, because this too can mitigate the way in which the injury proceeds to heal or not. So again, a very highly variable presentation we find in the literature, from slight visual loss to essentially legal blindness. And the recovery will take up to a year. In some cases, it may occur within a few months, in which case we know after the fact that it wasn't too severe. But the ones that take longer than that, of course, then all bets are off. Typically, the type of person that we see with these kinds of injuries, at least historically, has been a young adult male, young and stupid, and likely to remain so. many of them who are either unaware of warnings about how to protect their vision, or decided that those really didn't apply to them. And again, those of you who have teenage sons won't recognize the characteristics. Many of these people, therefore, were using either no protection or inadequate protection. And again, usually the first symptoms on the morning after the eclipse occurred. Now, we do know that there are two types of injury involved. There is what we call a blue light or photochemically based injury, which essentially is an overloading of the light-sensitive portion of the retinal photoreceptors. It's essentially like burning out the emulsion in a film. And normally, this is a temporary type of visual loss, which will gradually repair itself. What we don't want to see is an injury which is longer term, where we also have the involvement of either a very large image with the use of accessory optics, or an instance where the person has really stared at the sun for a very long time, long enough that not only the photochemical effect appears, but also a thermal. And it's the thermal one that really does the damage, because once the cell has been fried by the infrared, we're basically looking at tissue that has been cooked. And in this case here, taken from an Indian man who looked at a partial eclipse over the course of 2 hours or so, unprotected, you can see the individual crescent burns burnt into his retina. And indeed, this gentleman is legally blind in his eye. So the kind of damage we see, again, can vary considerably. Now, the problem that we have in looking at the history of eye injuries is that we have to rely a lot on the story told to us by our patients about the eye injuries. And this is something that always arises when we look at surveys of eclipse-related eye injuries. The most recent publication is by Simon Capely et al. With the Royal College of Ophthalmologists here in England, who did a study on cases reporting out of the United Kingdom after the 1999 eclipse. They were able to identify 70 cases that reported to hospital eye services or to private consultants. And in these cases, the one thing that was characteristic was that all of these injuries appeared to have resolved, at least from a clinically observable point of view, within a period of several weeks. It was interesting to see that among these 70 cases, there were a small number where the visual loss was quite profound and it was permanent. But for the majority, they did recover the visual acuity to the level almost of what they had prior to their injury. It's also interesting that the reporting time, that is, the date on which the cases were seen, varied from the very next day, for the earliest cases, to one case, which is particularly notorious, because the individual did not seek help until Christmas time. So you wonder what was going on with that particular individual, especially when you notice that for that particular case, it noted a profound loss of vision in one eye. You know, good thing you had a matched pair, I suppose. But it was really quite strange that there was this very extended initial reporting time for a very small number of cases. Also interesting in these data are the use of various types of eye protection during the eclipse. A third of the people used sunglasses, 50% said they didn't use anything else, and 15% claimed that they had used eclipse glasses. Now, I was asked to be a referee for this paper, and so I did query exactly what kind of question was asked about this, and it was simply a checkoff on the list. What type of device did they use? So we still have no idea of whether this was just something where the individual was trying to transfer the blame by saying, well, yeah, I had a pair of Eclipse glasses. Doesn't say that they actually used them. So we really don't know. But if they had used the Eclipse glasses in the way that they are instructed to do so, it's hard to understand how these 15% could actually have been injured. Well, given that, we take a look at the various observing methods. Most of you are familiar with these types of devices, all of which have proven rather reliable over the years. Certainly, we've got other things that have developed more recently, such as the metal-coated resins of various sorts. And these are the ones which, of course, have given rise to the solar eclipse glasses, as well as the handheld viewers and so on. I was involved here in the United Kingdom in 1999 in a little scuffle between the purveyors of the black polymer filters and the purveyors of the aluminized polyester. That was an interesting little firefight, and it eventually got solved, not to everybody's satisfaction, but it, as an interesting footnote, after the eclipse was come and gone, one of the major importers of the aluminized polyester was sued by the supplier in the United States for failure to pay his bill. And again, I was called in as one of the expert witnesses. And as far as I'm aware, the case went to court, and they had just opening the proceedings, and the judge gave a summary judgment without hearing any evidence, because we'd taken a look at the paper. It was interesting. Okay, with these types of filters that we're looking at, some of the newer ones that have come along, the black polymer consists of a polymer with carbon particles embedded in it. It originally was developed for visual use only, although sometimes it's used by people for photographic purposes. And then a new development has been the use of optically flat glass for the metal-coated glass filters. I guess it's because they figure that people like us can afford to go on trips, so maybe we can afford to have a better class of glass filter. And so they've developed those as a result. Here's the 1000 Oaks Polymer Plus filter. You can see that its transmittance is fairly uniform here. Slight Edelon effect or something. I think this is just interference from the two surfaces when we did the trace. And you can see the transmission is down here just above a millionth. In fact, this is a very, very dark filter. I find that, in fact, it's too dark. It's about a shade 15 equivalent. Very safe, but unless you've got an absolutely pristine sky, it's very difficult to see the sun through this product. Bader Astro Solar Safety Film, one of the competitors with the darkened resin base and the metallized coating on it. You can see here the result of the metallized coating. But again, a relatively safe filter, despite the fact that we've got this ultraviolet window here. It's still low enough that there really is clinically no particular reason to be concerned about this particular product at all. Coronado Systems, Coronado Technologies in Arizona has come out with a number of products over the last few years. They asked me to take a look at some of these. Vinomite is their solar binoculars, and they were a candidate for the National Geographic's 2003, I believe, Christmas catalog. I don't know whether it actually made it into that catalog or not, but that was the reason why they wanted me to look at them, because they were looking for a safety certification. They've since also brought out this white light filter, and then I started playing around with their H-alpha filters and along with a number of other products. Here's the Vinomite. Not surprisingly, the transmission curve for Vinomite is almost identical to what you will find in the better white light filter. The real difference between this filter and some of the other glass ones is that this is supposed to be an optically flat filter. and it does give a very, very sharp image. Along with it, they do supply this small eyepiece filter, which is the normally the green corona line of iron 14. It's a very, very sharp filter, which allows you to see flashes a little bit better, and works very nicely with almost any of the objective filters, whether they be the glass one or the resins. Thousands Oaks has come out with a competing product, a little bit less expensive, and as you can see, similar qualities here, except it's a little bit darker over on this side. Again, not a big surprise. A lot of attention is paid around here in the ultraviolet, which really doesn't need to be worried about particularly. The filter substrates themselves are very good filters of the ultraviolet. My main concern with all of these would be that we need to see these filters blocking off to about this level of 1 to the minus 3 here in the 10 to the minus 3 in the infrared to prevent the damage from infrared. The hydrogen alpha systems, a lot of people are starting to look at these, and so I started working with these. I do have an old Daystar of my own, and I acquired a Coronado as well. With these filters, they have similar combinations. You start off with an objective energy rejection filter, which, depending on the manufacturer, will remove certainly the ultraviolet and perhaps some of the infrared. You also have an Epsilon assembly. In the case of the Coronado systems that are now being marketed, it is an objective filter, whereas the competition's filters are all at the eyepiece end. And then you have a blocking filter, which further isolates the desired spectral line and also acts to remove any residual infrared that may have gotten through the rest of the system. And these combinations work fairly well in the H-alpha, but what's interesting to look at is what happens when we look at the infrared. Now, here's the Solar Max filter from Coronado. You have the blocking filter either in a diagonal like this, or in the case of the 30-millimeter blocking filter, it's a 2-inch straight-through system, and then here's your objective filter, and many of you realize that this is available in apertures of 40, 60, or 80 millimeters, depending on what your budget happens to be and how much resolution you want. But the T-Max is an assembly which screws on at the back of the objective unit here, and you just have a small thumb screw arrangement which allows you to then tilt the filter to tune it slightly. I find that with my arm reach, it's a difficulty even with a relatively short focus refractor. I use a 3-inch Oracle F7 unit, and if I'm at the eyepiece, I've got my arm fully stretched out to try and tune this particular filter. Tuning it is almost a two-man operation, but it gives very, very good images. Competing product now, SolarView 50, manufactured, this is from the Isle of Man, I believe, is it not? And in this case, you have the objective blocking filter here, you have the tiltable Epsilon in here, as well as the blocking filter. So, slightly different configuration. Thousand Oaks come out with one as well. You've got a red glass energy rejection filter, which takes out the shortwave end of the spectrum. And then you have the blocking filter unit here, which consists of a tiltable Epsilon stacked with the infrared filters in behind it. And here's the comparison of all of these. Unfortunately, some of the color choices were not particularly optimal. What you find is that in common, Coronado, SolarView, and Thousand Oaks all are transmitting at H-alpha at approximately a quarter of a percent transmission level. The transmission level for the Coronado is about the highest of them at between 0.35 and 0.4%. Daystar, on the other hand, is down at about 0.025%. And those of you who have used one will recognize that, in fact, that's one of the disadvantages of the air-spaced Edelon that they use in the Daystar technology. It renders the solar image extremely dim compared to the modern competition. What I do find a bit unsettling from looking at all this, I'm not sure if you can see the pale blue trace here, which is the solar view, compared to the other three. This one has quite a bit of infrared transmission down here, particularly beyond 1400 nanometers. Now, with the retina, we don't have to worry about this area down here, because this is what's going to be stopped by the cornea and the eyelids. And it's only this region in here that we have to worry about for retinal injury. Now, these levels here are low enough that, again, they're not a concern. But I would be a bit concerned about this, because with extended viewing, particularly if you use this with a fairly large aperture instrument, I think that the infrared dosage for superficial skin burns might be a problem. Certainly, I think that it's a possibility that with extended exposure, there might be a sensation of heat on the front, on the eyelids and so on with this particular device. But again, I haven't had a chance to use this, so I can't speak from personal experience about how well that, about whether that would happen, but it's certainly a word of caution. I would be looking to see if they can put in some form of additional infrared protection to bring this trace up a little bit further, so that in fact it's going to be transmitting about maybe 10% of that infrared as it currently is doing now. Now, the thing is that my concern arises from the fact that certainly in North America we're seeing astronomy in the schools much more than we used to. And solar observing is certainly very popular with the teachers because they can do it in the day. They don't have to come back at night. And it's a relatively easy thing to do, at least I think so. Certainly, if we take a look at the Pan-Canadian curriculum on which the province of Ontario based many of the points of its science curriculum, certainly we see that there are things that are specifically mentioned in the curriculum that deal with observing the sun. Here's the grade 6 curriculum. And my goodness, that specific. You know, follow the safety procedures, blah, blah, blah. We take a look at the other point where astronomy is brought into the school curriculum. Here's the grade 9 academic, which is for people who are intending to go to university or community college. And in the universe space science thing, again, they do mention things about the use of equipment to observe various celestial objects, including the sun. And for the applied, which is for the less academically skilled, we have a similar kind of thing. But interestingly enough, here they do have some more specific indications about observing, such as graphing the sunrise and sunset times and so on. So astronomy has a fairly strong root then in the school curriculum, at least as it's written. Whether it's actually delivered is another matter, because certainly I think those of us who have had to deal with these curriculum matters in the Pan-Canadian curriculum have found that teachers are petrified of astronomy in the Canadian school system, and in fact try to put this part of the unit towards the end of the year, hoping that they'll run out of time. So it's a bit frustrating from that point of view after many years. Why is this important? Well, it arises from a case in which I was called as an expert witness that arose out of the 1998 February eclipse. Now, this was a grade 9 physical science class in a high school in North Carolina, where obviously they were well out of the path of totality, but there had been some news coverage of it. And the grade 9 teacher had been aware of the eclipse and made a spur-of-the-moment decision to take the class outside to watch the partial phases, despite the fact that the school had given instructions that nobody was to go outside and look at the eclipse that day. Well, how did this particular teacher prepare for it? Well, she had taken a look at the eye safety information on the internet, and specifically she'd gone to the Sky and Telescope website, and funnily enough had landed on the web pages that held my article on solar filters from 1998. What was it, 1998 or so? I forget exactly when that was published, the second one. But in any case, that was online, and she had looked at that. And then after having read that you could use a metal-coated filter, she started searching through the science catalog that was in the prep room and decided that cobalt glass, which was advertised in the Flynn catalog, was the filter that she would use. And in fact, in the deposition that I received from a lawyer, there was a statement that the teacher had given that she was of the opinion that cobalt glass was a light filtering glass and therefore would be satisfactory. Notice light filtering, not metal coated filter. And that was the key. Well, anyway, what happened was, again, the principal on the fateful day decided that he would follow the instructions from the board and announced that no one was to go outside to look. But this teacher made a spur-of-the-moment decision to, in fact, take the class outside. In doing so, what she did was issue 2-inch cobalt glass squares to the class and instructed them to look at the sun through the glass and make your observations that way. Now, those of you who know glass will recognize that cobalt glass is an art glass which is rendered by the addition of cobalt oxide to the mix as a brilliant blue. And in fact, it's prized as an art glass. It's also used in some industrial filters, although it's known that it transmits a lot of infrared. And typically, its use industrially has been to look at char beds or coal beds in industrial furnaces to gauge the temperature of the coals from the appearance of the ashes through the cobalt glass. It's not meant for extended use, such as looking at an eclipse. Well, the result was that the class did successfully observe the eclipse. Remember, this is the afternoon of the 26th. The next day, 6 students came in out of that class complaining that their vision was funny. And they made the complaint to the teacher. The teacher decided, you know, this is 6 boys, the teacher decided this was conspiracy. And so she ignored their complaints and, in fact, took away their lab privileges for the term for disrupting her class. That was the way she had it. Well, the kids went off, they complained to their parents, they went and got eye examinations, and the consultants at that point did confirm that each one of these 6 children had, in fact, incurred solar retinopathy. And as a result, lawsuits were filed against the teacher in the school district. Well, some of the matter was that the teacher was found negligent due to inadequate preparation. One of the things that happened was that she had called the local planetarium in the city in North Carolina, and it was the public information number which had a taped message about the eclipse, but she never went through the follow-up stage of actually contacting the planetarium staff directly. She just let it drop at that point. Also, the cobalt glass was a problem. She didn't follow the recommendations of the Sky and Telescope website, that is my webpage, in the sense that the cobalt filters were not metal-coated. In fact, they're transparent. Which led to the other part of the negligence, which was she did not properly investigate the properties of the cobalt glass, and the result was there is direct harm as a result of these actions. That fulfills all the legal requirements of negligence in this case.
Now, here's the cobalt glass transmittance. This is one of the filters that, in fact, is used. So here we have the transmittance. One is 100% transmittance, zero plus there. You notice that we've got this very high transmittance in the blue region of the spectrum, and then we have this this additional very high transmittance here in the infrared. This is what did the damage to the kids. Here is an example of one student that I was called in on, the last of the cases, 20/25 visual acuity. So after the event, he ended up with a foveal scar. If we look at the visual field, there is a small puckering or distortion right in the middle of his visual field. The Snellen acuity, 20/25, still well within the limits for driving for North American jurisdictions. The big complaint was he couldn't go squirrel hunting anymore. He couldn't sight his rifle. And in this case, the finding was, again, negligence. The fact that he couldn't use his rifle scope and therefore had adversely been affected in terms of lifestyle net, but the court found a liability of approximately $40,000 for a minor visual injury. Well, actually, there was a settlement which was approved by the court. Now, each of these children, in fact, went through this. The last settlement was in the spring of 2003, so it took 5 years to go through the court system. The settlements involved both punitive damages as well as exemplary damages as well as legal costs. So cash awards ranged from about $10,000 for the first child to about $40,000 for this last of the six, plus all the legal costs for the children's families, plus the school district's legal costs. So you can add it up that there was considerable expense incurred as a result of this. It just underscores the fact that when you have these kinds of problems of inadequate preparation and so on, it's going to cost people dear. And again, it is a word of caution for everybody that, you know, you have to choose words carefully, and you have to hope that people who are listening to you or reading you will in fact understand what you're saying. So again, something to take back when we're devising public education messages. So on that uncheerful note, I shall end. And if there are any questions, I'd love to answer.
If you go back to your earlier, I once had an ear problem, which it turned out was helped by the fact that a good ear doctor told me to take steroids in a 72-hour window. The fact that you have a 24-hour window in the eye makes me ask, should we all be taking a couple of steroid pills the day after an infection, just in case? Would it help?
Well, in fact, that's a very good question, because one of the earlier papers dealing with eclipse eye damage, solar retinopathy in general, did advise that injected steroids might be a way of dealing with the swelling that is characteristic of these injuries. In fact, it turns out that in the case of eye damage, injected steroids do not do any good. And the kind of steroid that they're dealing with, applied on a systemic basis, is quite risky. So there are a number of reasons why we wouldn't want to use that anyway. It's unfortunately a situation where the standard of practice now is let nature take its course. There's really not much else you can do.
During the pregnancies of the last century, I have read about one such experiment by a Canadian professor. He wanted to know how long it takes until an unprotected eye will be blinded when looking into the uneclipsed sun. And it was quoted that that it took 2 minutes. I suppose that the eye which he sacrificed was yet a little bit injured. But what do you know about such effect? Is it believable or not?
It is believable. There have been a number of studies done. Now, we can't do that kind of study anymore. First of all, one of the problems you have now is that we're, in the life sciences, you're hampered by something called research ethics. And so this kind of study, particularly on animals and humans, is very, very difficult to get approvals for anymore. The last of the studies that were done of that sort were on rhesus monkey in the 1980s. Before that, the best source of studies was using patients who were already scheduled to have blood ties taken out because of malignant melanoma. And the two-hour, or rather the two-minute exposure time is about what we see from all of these studies. They are fairly consistent. The questions that we always have, though, is what is the role of the micro-movements that are always present in the eyes? You may think that your vision is very, very rock steady when you're looking at a small object, but in fact, there's a very, very tiny high-frequency oscillation of the eye. And the reason for that is because the visual reaction in the retina requires variable stimulation of the retina. It's got to be at about 20 hertz or 30 hertz in order for you to maintain vision. If you absolutely freeze the eye, the Troxler's effect will cause the vision to fade out. And it's literally because you're exhausting the photoreceptors. Now, the thing is that we know that, particularly with a fairly extended object, if we have a relatively steady exposure that gets 2 minutes to the right time, if we look at intermittent exposures over a long period of time, such as we see in eclipses, you know, periodic glances, looking away, doing something else, then going back to look. Then, again, if we integrate the time, it's a little bit longer than the 2 minutes, but it's still within, you know, it's within the order of magnitude. So, again, it's all very, very consistent.
Thank you, Ralph.